Hey there, it's Cory Doctorow, and it's my podcast again, reading to you one more time from Bruce Sterling's wonderful history of the early days of the electronic frontier, which is called The Hacker Crackdown, the first piece of literary freeware I ever read, and I'm now reading aloud to you with permission of the author. Thank you, Bruce. I'm reading this to you from Viable Paradise, the science fiction writing workshop that goes for a week every year on the island of Martha's Vineyard off Massachusetts, off Cape Cod. And I'm meeting with a very, very good group of students this year, as I did last year. Just some really outstanding manuscripts in the group this year, and I'm looking forward to seeing these folks collect their awards and their major publications and so on as the years go by. It certainly sometimes gives you a real sense of moment to work with students who you know are going to really go far. Almost didn't make it to Viable Paradise. I landed in Boston the other night on my way back from the Picnic Conference in Amsterdam. Thanks to everyone who came up and said hello to me there. And I'd been told before leaving, I called the American Consulate in London and said, "So I'm going to America and I'm doing a little teaching and I'm giving a couple of speeches." And they said, "Okay, yeah, that's no problem. Provided you don't give more than five speeches in 6 months, you don't need a work visa, even if you're collecting an honorarium." And when I landed, the INS said, or the DHS said, "No, in fact, that's wrong. And we should probably deport you to England now and never let you into the country again for trying to illegally enter to work." So that kind of freaked me out. They eventually relented, which was very kind of them. But it's a little weird. The American Embassy in London has a toll number that you have to call. It's about $3 a minute to get advice on your immigration and visa information for the United States, and they just told me wrong stuff. So now I'm teeing up to spend a lot of money to get an O visa, the extraordinary ability visa for my subsequent trips to the U.S. No fun at all. I miss the open borders of Europe. So what else? I got The Galleys of Little Brother, my hacker novel about people who hacker kids who fight the Department of Homeland Security to win back the Bill of Rights. It's looking really good, and it's still on track for a May publication. And I heard from several of you that the previous installment of this podcast cut off mid-sentence. I'm very sorry about that. I don't know how that happened. I will pick it up from the sentence that it cut off in, and read to you from there. And actually, without further ado, I think it's time for me to do that reading. So here we go. The so-called internet is not actually a network itself, but rather an internetwork connection standard that allows several globe-spanning computer networks to communicate with one another. Readers fascinated by the weird and intricate tangles of modern computer networks may enjoy John S. Quatermain's authoritative 719-page explication, The Matrix, from Digital Press, 1990. A skilled user of Terminus's Unix machine could send and receive electronic mail from almost any major computer network in the world. NetSys was not called a board per se, but rather a node. Nodes were larger, faster, and more sophisticated than mere boards, and for hackers, hanging out on internationally connected nodes was quite a step up from merely hanging out on local boards. Terminus's NetSys node in Maryland had a number of direct links to other similar UUCP nodes run by people who shared his interests and at least something of his freewheeling attitude. One of these nodes was JOLNET, owned by Richard Andrews, who, like Terminus, was something of an independent Unix consultant. JOLNET also ran Unix and could be contacted at high speed by mainframe machines from all over the world. JOLNET was quite a sophisticated piece of work, technically speaking, but it was still run by an individual as a private, not-for-profit hobby. JOLNET was mostly used by other Unix programmers for mail, storage, and access to networks. JOLNET supplied network access. Well, I guess that's a typo. Also supplied network access to about 200 people, as well as a local junior college. Among its various features and services, JOLNET also carried FRAC magazine. For reasons of his own, Richard Andrews had become suspicious of a new user called Robert Johnson. Richard Andrews took it upon himself to have a look at what Robert Johnson was storing in JOLNET, and Andrews found the E911 document. Robert Johnson was the prophet from the Legion of Doom, and the E91 document was illicitly copied data from the prophet's raid on BellSouth's computer. The E911 document, a particularly illicit piece of digital property, was about to resume its long, complex, and disastrous career. It struck Andrews as fishy that someone not a telephone employee should have a document referring to the enhanced 911 system. Besides, the document itself bore an obvious warning. Warning: not for use or disclosure outside Bell South or any of its subsidiaries except under written agreement. These standard non-disclosure tags are often applied to all sorts of corporate material. Telcos as a species are particularly notorious for stamping most everything in sight as not for use or disclosure. Still, this particular piece of data was about the 911 system. That sounded bad to Rich Andrews. Andrews was not prepared to ignore this sort of trouble. He thought it would be wise to pass the document along to a friend and acquaintance in the Unix network for consultation. So, around September 1988, Andrews sent yet another copy of the E911 document electronically to an AT&T employee, one Charles Boykin, who ran a Unix-based node called ATT-CTC in Dallas, Texas. ATT-CTC was the property of AT&T and was run from AT&T's Customer Technology Center in Dallas, hence the name ATT-CTC. ATT-CTC was better known as Killer, the name of the machine that the system was running on. Killer was a hefty, powerful AT&T 3B2500 model, a multi-user, multitasking Unix platform with 32 megs of memory and a mind-boggling 3.2 gigabytes of storage. When Killer had first arrived in Texas in 1985, the 3B2 had been one of AT&T's great white hopes for going head-to-head with IBM for the corporate computer hardware market. Killer had been shipped to the Customer Technology Center in the Dallas Infomart, essentially a high-technology mall, and there it sat, a demonstration model. Charles Boykin, a veteran AT&T hardware and digital communications expert, was a local technical backup man for the AT&T 3B2 system. As a display model in the Infomart mall, Killer had little to do, and it seemed a shame to waste the system's capacity. So Boykin ingeniously wrote some Unix bulletin board system software for Killer and plugged the machine into the local phone network. Killer's debut in late 1985 made it the first publicly available Unix site in the state of Texas. Anyone who wanted to play was welcome. The machine immediately attracted an electronic community. It joined the UUCP network and offered network links to over 80 other computer sites, all of which became dependent on computer for their links to the greater world of cyberspace. And it wasn't just for the big guys. Personal computer users also stored freeware programs for the Amiga, the Apple, the IBM, and the Macintosh on Killer's vast 3,200 meg archives. At one time, Killer had the largest library of public domain Macintosh software in Texas. Eventually, Killer attracted about 1,500 users, all busily communicating, uploading and downloading, getting mail, gossiping, and linking to arcane and distant networks. Boykin received no pay for running Killer. He considered it good publicity for the AT&T 3B2 system, whose sales were somewhat less than stellar, but he also simply enjoyed the vibrant community his skill had created. He gave away the bulletin board Unix software he had written, free of charge. In the Unix programming community, Charles Boykin had the reputation of a warm, open-hearted, level-headed kind of guy. In 1989, a group of Texan Unix professionals voted Boykin System Administrator of the Year. He was considered a fellow you could trust for good advice. In September 1988, without warning, the E911 document came plunging into Boykin's life, forwarded by Richard Andrews. Boykin immediately recognized that the document was hot property. He was not a voice communications man, and he knew little about the ins and outs of the baby bells, but he certainly knew what the 911 system was, and he was angry to see confidential data in the hands of a no-goodnik. This was clearly a matter for telco security. So, on September 21, 1988, Boykin made yet another copy of the E911 document and passed this one along to a professional acquaintance of his, one Jerome Dalton, from AT&T Corporate Information Security. Jerry Dalton was the very fellow who would later raid Terminus's house. From AT&T's security division, the E911 document went to Bellcore. Bellcore, or Bell Communications Research, had once been the central laboratory of the Bell system. Bell Labs employees had invented the Unix operating system. Now Bellcore was a quasi-independent, jointly owned company that acted as the research arm for all seven of the baby Bell's RBOCs. Belcor was in a good position to coordinate security technology and consultation for the RBOX, and the gentleman in charge of this effort was Henry M. Klupfel, a veteran of the Bell system who had worked there for 24 years. On October 13, 1988, Dalton passed the E911 document to Henry Klupfel. Klupfel, a veteran expert witness in telecommunications fraud and computer fraud cases, had certainly seen worse trouble than this. He recognized the document for what it was, a trophy from a hacker breakdown. However, whatever harm had been done in the intrusion was presumably old news. At this point, there seemed little to be done. Klupfel made a careful note of the circumstances and shelved the problem for the time being. Whole months passed. February 1989 arrived. The Atlanta 3 were living it up in Bell South switches and had not yet met their comeuppance. The Legion was thriving. So was Frack magazine. A good 6 months had passed since the Prophet's AIM-SX break-in. Prophet, as hackers will, grew weary of sitting on his laurels. Night Lightning and Taryn King, the editors of Frack, were always begging Prophet for material they could publish. Prophet decided that the heat must be off by this time, and that he could safely brag, boast, and strut. He sent a copy of the E911 document, yet another one, from Rich Andrews' JoelNet machine to Night Lightning's BitNet account at the University of Missouri. Let's review the fate of the document so far. 0. The original E911 document. This in the AIM-SX system on a mainframe system computer in Atlanta, available to hundreds of people, but all of them presumably Bell South employees. An unknown number of them may have their own copies of this document, but they are all professionals and trusted by the phone company. 1. Prophet's illicit copy at home on his computer in Decatur, Georgia. 2. Prophet's backup company, stored on Rich Andrews' JoelNet machine in the basement of Rich Andrews' house near Joliet, Illinois. 3. Charles Boykin's copy on Killer in Dallas, sent by Rich Andrews from JoelNet. 4. Jerry Dalton's copy at AT&T Corporate Information Security in New Jersey, sent from Charles Boykin in Dallas. 5. Henry Klupfel's copy at Belcor Security Headquarters in New Jersey, sent by Dalton. 6. Night Lightning's copy, sent by Prophet from Rich Andrews' machine, now in Columbia, Missouri. We can see that the security situation of this proprietary document, once dug out of AIM-SX, swiftly became bizarre. Without any money changing hands, without any particular special effort, this data had been reproduced at least 6 times, and had spread itself all over the continent. But by far the worst, however, has yet to come. In February 1989, Prophet and Night Lightning bargained electronically over the fate of this trophy. Prophet wanted to boast, but at the same time was scarcely wanted to be caught. For his part, Night Lightning was eager to publish as much of the document as he could manage. Night Lightning was a fledgling political science major with a particular interest in freedom of information issues. He would gladly publish most anything that would reflect glory on the prowess of the underground and embarrass the telcos. However, Night Lightning himself had contacts in telco security and sometimes consulted on them on material he'd received that might be too dicey for publication. Prophet and Night Lightning decided to edit the E911 document so as to delete most of its identifying traits. First of all, its large not-for-user-disclosure warning had to go. Then there were other matters. For instance, it listed the office telephone numbers of several Bell South 911 specialists in Florida. If these numbers were published in Frack, the Bell South employees involved would very likely be hassled by phone freaks, which would anger Bell South no end, and pose a definite operational hazard both for Prophet and for Frack. So Night Lightning cut the document almost in half, removing the phone numbers and some of the touchier and more specific information. He passed it back electronically to Prophet. Prophet was still nervous, so Night Lightning cut a bit more. They finally agreed that it was ready to go, and that it would be published in Frack under the pseudonym The Eavesdropper. And this was done on February 25th, 1989. The 24th issue of Frack featured a chatty interview with co-ed phone freak Chandelier, 3 articles on BitNet and its links to other computer networks, an article on 800 and 900 numbers by Unknown User, Vax Cat's article on telco basics, slyly entitled Lifting Ma Bell's Veil of Secrecy, and the usual Frack World News. The news section, with painful irony, featured an extended account of the sentencing of Shadow Hawk, an 18-year-old Chicago hacker who had just been put in federal prison by William J. Cook himself. And then there were two articles by the eavesdropper. The first was the edited E911 document, now titled Control Office Administration of Enhanced 911 Services for Special Services and Major Account Centers. Eavesdropper's second article was a glossary of terms explaining the blizzard of telco acronyms and buzzwords in the E911 document. The hapless document was now distributed in the usual frack routine to a good 150 sites. Not 150 people, mind you, 150 sites. Some of these sites linked to Unix nodes or bulletin board systems, which themselves had readerships of tens, hundreds, even thousands of people. This was February 1989. Nothing happened immediately. Summer came, and the Atlanta crew were raided by the Secret Service. Fry Guy was apprehended. Still, nothing whatever happened to Frack. Six more issues of Frack came out, 30 in all, more or less on a monthly schedule. Night Lightning and co-editor Taryn King went untouched. Frack tended to duck and cover whenever the heat came down. During the summer bust of 1987, hacker bust tended to cluster in summer, perhaps because hackers were easier to find at home than in college, Frack had ceased publication for several months and laid low. Several LOD hangers-on had been arrested, but nothing had happened to the Frack crew. And the premier gossips of the underground. In 1988, Frack had been taken over by a new editor, Crimson Death, a raucous youngster with a taste for anarchy files. 1989, however, looked like a bounty year for the underground. Night Lightning and his co-editor Taryn King took up the reins again, and Frack flourished through 1989. The Atlanta LOD went down hard in the summer of 1989, but Frack rolled merrily along. Prophet's E911 document seemed unlikely to cause Frack any trouble. By January 1990, it had been available in Frack for almost a year. Klupfel and Dalton, officers of Bellcore and AT&T Security, had possessed the document for 16 months. In fact, they'd had it even before Night Lightning himself, and had done nothing in particular to stop the distribution. They hadn't even told Rich Andrews or Charles Boykin to erase the copies from their Unix systems, Jolnet and Killer. But then came the monster Martin Luther King Day crash of January 5th, 1990. A flat 3 days later, on January 18th, four agents showed up at Night Lightning's fraternity house. One was Timothy Foley, the second Barbara Golden, both of them Secret Service agents from the Chicago office. Also along was a University of Missouri security officer, and Reed Newland, a security man from Southwestern Bell, the RBOC having jurisdiction over Missouri. Foley accused Night Lightning of causing the nationwide crash of the phone system. Night Lightning was aghast at this allegation. On the face of it, the suspicion was not entirely implausible, though Night Lightning knew that he himself hadn't done it. Plenty of hot dog hackers had bragged that they could crash the phone system, however. Shadowhawk, for instance, the Chicago hacker whom William Cook had recently put in jail, had several times boasted on boards that he could shut down AT&T's public switch network. And now this event, or something that looked just like it, had actually taken place. The crash had lit a fire under the Chicago task force, and the former fence-sitters at Bellcore and AT&T were now ready to roll. The consensus among telco security, already horrified at the skill of the Bell South intruders, was that the digital underground was out of hand. LOD and Frack must go. And in publishing Prophet's E911 document, Frack had provided law enforcement with what appeared to be a powerful legal weapon. Foley confronted Night Lightning about the E911 document. Night Lightning was cowed. He immediately began cooperating fully, in the usual tradition of the digital underground. He gave Foley a complete run of Frack, printed out in a set of three-ring binders. He handed over his electronic mailing list to Frack subscribers. Night Lightning was grilled for 4 hours by Foley and his cohorts. Night Lightning admitted that Prophet had passed him the E911 document, and he admitted that he had known it was stolen booty from a hacker raid on a telephone company. Night Lightning signed a statement to this effect, and agreed, in writing, to cooperate with the investigators. Next day, January 19, 1990, a Friday, the Secret Service returned with a search warrant. Returned with a search warrant and thoroughly searched Night Lightning's upstairs room in the fraternity house. They took all his floppy disks, though, interestingly, they'd left Night Lightning in possession of both his computer and his modem. The computer had no hard disk, and in Foley's judgment, was not a store of evidence. But this was a very minor bright spot among Night Lightning's rapidly multiplying troubles. By this time, Night Lightning was in plenty of hot water, not only with the federal police, prosecutors, and telco investigators, but university security, along with the elders of his own campus fraternity, who were outraged to think that they had been unwittingly harboring a federal computer criminal. On Monday, Night Lightning was summoned to Chicago, where he was further grilled by Foley and USSS veteran agent Barbara Golden, this time with an attorney present. And on Tuesday, he was formally indicted by a federal grand jury. The trial of Night Lightning, which occurred on January 24th through 27th, 1990, was a crucial show trial of the hacker crackdown. We will examine the trial at some length in Part 4 of this book. In the meantime, we must continue our dogged pursuit of the E911 document. It must have been clear by January 1990 that the E911 document, in the form Frackett published it back in February 1989, had gone off at the speed of light in at least 150 different directions. To attempt to put this electronic genie back in the bottle was flatly impossible. And yet, the E911 document was still stolen property, formally and legally speaking. Any electronic transference of this document by anyone unauthorized to have it could be interpreted as an act of wire fraud. Interstate transfer of stolen property, including electronic property, was a federal crime. The Chicago Computer Fraud and Abuse Task Force had been assured that the E911 document was worth a hefty sum of money. In fact, they had a precise estimate of its worth from the Bell South security personnel, $79,449. A sum of this scale seemed to warrant vigorous prosecution. Even if the damage could not be undone, at least the large sum offered a good legal pretext for stern punishment of the thieves. It seemed likely to impress judges and juries, and it could be used in court to mop up the Legion of Doom. The Atlanta crowd was already in the bag by the time the Chicago task force had gotten around to frack. But the Legion was a hydra-headed thing. In late 1989, a brand new Legion of Doom board, Phoenix Project, had gone up in Austin, Texas. Phoenix Project was sysoped by no less a man than the mentor himself, ably assisted by University of Texas student and hardened doomster Eric Bloodaxe. As we have seen from his frack manifesto, the mentor was a hacker zealot, who regarded computer intrusion as something close to a moral duty. Phoenix Project was an ambitious effort, intended to revive the digital underground to what mentor considered the full flower of the early 80s. The Phoenix board would also boldly bring elite hackers face-to-face with the telco opposition. On Phoenix, America's cleverest hackers would supposedly shame the telco squareheads out of their stick-in-the-mud attitudes, and perhaps convince them that the Legion of Doom elite were really an all-right crew. The premiere of Phoenix Project was heavily trumpeted by Frack, and Phoenix Project carried a complete run of Frack issues, including the E911 document as Frack had published it. Phoenix Project was only one of many, possibly hundreds, of nodes and boards all over America that were in guilty possession of the E911 document. But Phoenix was an outright, unashamed Legion of Doom board. Under Mentor's guidance, it was flaunting itself in the face of telco security personnel. Worse yet, it was actively trying to win them over as sympathizers for the digital underground elite. Phoenix, who had no cards or codes, for the digital underground elite, Phoenix had no cards or codes on it. Its hacker elite considered Phoenix at least technically legal. But Phoenix was a corrupting influence, where hacker anarchy was eating away, like digital acid, at the underbelly of corporate propriety. The Chicago Computer Fraud and Abuse Task Force was now prepared to descend on Austin, Texas.